Good morning, and thank you for coming this morning to hear these papers. And I wish we had had more time to hear more of your paper, Claudrina. I think I would have continued to learn a lot this morning. And I want to pick up the chronology here and sort of extend it into the 1940s and extend it into an arena that we'll be talking about in the next panel, and that is education and the litigation campaign pursued by the NAACP. In April 1948, Judge Sterling Hutchison of the Fourth Circuit U.S. District Court issued a ruling concerning the schools in King George and Gloucester counties, and both of these counties lie in the eastern part of Virginia, declaring the educational opportunities for black children not substantially equal to those furnished to white children. Judge Hutchison ordered the school boards to stop discriminating against African Americans. In an order issued in July, he required county officials to equalize the school buildings, equipment, and facilities by that September. NAACP activists knew there was little chance that this would happen. Martin A. Martin, lead attorney for the plaintiffs, had no sympathy. Black parents in those localities had been asking for school improvements for years, he told a newspaper reporter. The school board officials, Martin said, arrogantly refused to do anything. They would not cooperate with us then, but now will charge us with being very unreasonable. He insisted that, quote, it is not our intention or aim to place colored children in the so-called white schools in Virginia, but unless these Virginia school boards, all of them, change their attitude, Martin warned, colored and white children in Virginia will be attending classes in the same schools in September. Martin's threat of black and white children attending school together reminds us that in the 1940s, litigation was a confrontational strategy, as blacks asserted their citizenship rights while boldly challenging whites' control of the pace of racial and social change. Moreover, litigating inequalities in segregated education was, in Thurgood Marshall's words, a brand new field of law. In Virginia, NAACP activists mapped out the methods and refined the legal arguments the association would use to challenge educational inequalities across the South. The cases in King George and Gloucester counties provide us with an opportunity to see how black and white Virginians responded to the NAACP's litigation campaign. By examining how these court challenges played out at the local level, we can restore a sense of contingency to what scholars often call the road to Brown, as well as we can see the context out of which massive resistance to the Brown decision emerged. As Martin observed, African-American parents in King George and Gloucester had been working for decades to improve education for their children. They lobbied for free bus transportation and better books and equipment. Pleading poverty, school officials negotiated with black parents to pay for school improvements themselves in return for additional help from the school board. In Gloucester, for instance, parents raised $1,500 to buy floors and seatings for the gymnasium at the King George Training School. At the Gloucester Training School. Parents installed the flooring themselves, so they paid for it, they installed it themselves, and the school board refused to help them out further. Frustrated by the intransigence of school officials, parents in those counties sought outside help from the Virginia State Teachers Association, the professional association of black teachers in the state, and the Virginia State Conference of the NAACP. And of course, as many of you know, beginning in the 1930s, the NAACP had initiated a legal campaign to challenge segregation in education. Virginia proved to be a key battleground in this campaign. In 1935, NAACP activists organized the Virginia State Conference of the NAACP to build support for the association among black Virginians and to coordinate legal challenges and inequalities in education. The Virginia Conference was the first state conference in the South. Oklahoma actually founded its state conference in 1931, and so I know Oklahoma is sometimes considered a southern state, so I do want to point that out. But by 1941, with 39 branches, Virginia's was the largest state conference in the nation. In addition, Virginia was home to a highly motivated and talented cadre of black attorneys, many of whom had been trained at Howard Law School by Dean Charles Houston, who, of course, conceived the NAACP's legal strategy. These attorneys included, most notably, Oliver Hill, Martin A. Martin, and Spotswood Robinson, and they would bring on a younger generation of attorneys who would continue the struggle through the 1950s and 1960s and into the 1970s. These attorneys, beginning in the early 1940s, initiated a wide-ranging litigation campaign that challenged discrimination in all arenas of Southern life, in education, transportation, employment, in the criminal justice system. They worked closely with the national NAACP legal staff and with local black communities, channeling their grievances into organized collective action. With the end of World War II, the NAACP began to really focus in on inequalities in elementary and high school education. Noting how state governments were making elaborate plans for education after the war, Thurgood Marshall warned that the, quote, the policy of discrimination against Negroes will continue unless we move and move fast. Marshall called together attorneys in early 1946 to gather in Atlanta to try and map out a litigation strategy to challenge inequalities in education at the elementary and high school levels. And Hill and Robinson from Virginia attended that conference. They determined there that they could not ask the courts to outright equalize the schools for black and white children, because fundamentally the NAACP didn't recognize the legality of segregation statutes. Therefore, the lawyers intended to ask the courts to stop school boards from discriminating against black children. And this is a key distinction, because what this did then is left it up to school boards and to school officials and the courts to determine what equal educational opportunities meant. Hill, Martin, and Robinson vigorously pursued these cases after this meeting in 1946. By the next year, by February of 1947, they had legal actions in various stages in 15 counties in Virginia, including King George and Gloucester counties. And based on the work that they had already commenced that fall in November of 1947, Thurgood Marshall picked Virginia as the site of an intensive campaign to, quote, clean up the educational system county by county. He selected Virginia not only for the, quote, glaring inequalities in its school system, but also based on the membership and fundraising strength of the Virginia State Conference. Marshall asserted that the cases already pending, quote, will make the groundwork for a full-scale legal attack on the segregation laws of the state of Virginia. And after World War II, Virginia had an even stronger network of branches to draw upon for this campaign. By 1946, the Virginia State Conference had 91 branches and almost 25,000 members. And compared to national NAACP membership, only Texas had more branches than Virginia. And Virginia was fourth in membership behind Texas, Ohio, and California. Spotswood Robinson orchestrated the legal campaign on the ground, and he was assisted by Virginia State Conference Executive Secretary Lester Banks. They crisscrossed the state in Banks' car, meeting with local communities, investigating school conditions, securing authorizations from parents, filing petitions with school boards, and hammering out court documents. Robinson was known to type them while in the car traveling around the state. By June 1948, the litigation campaign included 63 of Virginia's 102 school divisions. But once the NAACP won a favorable decision in court, would local school boards comply? And this was the question NAACP activists sought to answer when they went to King George and Gloucester counties on the first day of school in September 1948. Attorneys Robinson and Hill led the inspection at the Gloucester Training School. The school board had made cosmetic improvements, they had painted some of the woodwork, they had repaired broken windows, but there was still no central heating system like the White High School had. Oliver Hill turned on one of the newly installed water fountains outside, and water shot up 20 feet in the air, quipped to a news reporter that they might think about turning the water pressure down. And new equipment, some new equipment have been added, but a lot of the equipment have just been brought over from the White High School. It was hand-me-downs from the White High School. Overall, the men concluded that the Gloucester Training School remained inferior to the two white high schools in the county. The inspection at King George Training School yielded similar conclusions. And Martin and Lester Banks led the inspections there. Officials had put up a new outside toilet to replace the one that had fallen down. They installed a water fountain, this time without enough water pressure, and they fixed some broken windows. Some 2,000 books had been sent over to the school for a library and piled up in the wooden shack that served as the principal's office on the school grounds. The books included, and let me just remind you, it's 1948, the books included the 1905 report of the Librarian of Congress, the 1925 yearbook of the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace, and the 1937 Technical Journal of the Bell Telephone System. A volume entitled Love Letters of Worldly Women, and several books written in German, even though the school didn't offer the foreign language, rounded out the collection. Martin commented, 95% of those books I saw were worse than useless for school children. A journalist for the Richmond Afro-American captured some of the frustration and insult these men must have felt at the inspections. He was convinced that, quote, one of two things was true of these school officials. Either they are certain beyond doubt that all colored persons, including NAACP lawyers and school patrons in that county, are nincompoops, too dumb to know what it is all about, or they are convinced that the federal court won't dare enforce its order against them. Faced with these inequalities, attorneys told parents and students not to register at their schools, but plan to register at the white high schools instead. And the attorneys knew that they wouldn't actually be accepted from the white schools. This was more of a tactical strategy. They said it was a way to protect the rights of the parents and students if the judge asked them had they tried to enroll at the school. So Martin takes a group of students over to register students at King George High School, and he has a confrontation there with the school superintendent, who is named Martin Gale. Gale explained that by asking him to register black students, he would violate his oath to uphold the Constitution and laws of the state of Virginia. Martin replied, "It appears to me that the laws of Virginia are contrary to the Constitution and laws of the United States." Turning red, Gale retorted, "That is only your opinion." Martin asserted that where there was conflict between the federal Constitution and the state laws, the Constitution was supreme. Gale explained, "I expected you people to be reasonable on this." And this confrontation, I wish I could get the copies of the newspaper pictures in a form that looks good, because black students were standing looking on at this confrontation, sort of white parents are further out in the parking lot sort of seeing what's going on. So this is a very public confrontation. Now, within weeks of the attempts to register the students, local officials began pressuring black citizens to stop their pursuit of equality. The most publicized actions occurred in King George County. Superintendent Gale there demoted the principal and two teachers at the training school and put them under supervision of the white principal at King George High School. The superintendent claimed to do this because it made the schools more efficient. And this will be an excuse that will be used in the 1950s all over Virginia to do things like close the schools. Furthermore, local officials sent a petition to the PTA members of the King George Training School, asking them to sign it before the county would be willing to hold a bond referendum to build a new school for black students. The text of the petition called upon black parents to denounce communism and to repudiate their affiliation with the NAACP, who, in the words of the petition, attempted to turn class against class and race against race. Moreover, it asked PTA members to, quote, affirm their abiding faith in the white race, as well as to affirm their belief that white and black children should be taught in separate schools, quote, realizing that through this policy, both the white and colored races will live more harmonious and progressive lives. The PTA rejected the petition outright. They declared their support for the NAACP and stated that they resented the implication that the leaders and the followers in the fight to secure the constitutional rights of the Negro schoolchildren are in any way connected with communism. They also said that this statement about affirming their faith in the white race, they called it pure balderdash. And they said, quote, "We place our faith and hopes in those individuals who, irrespective of their race or religion, are permeated with and practice the principles of democracy as set forth in the Constitution and the laws of the United States and the principles of Christianity and brotherly love as expounded by Jesus Christ." Faced with these continuing school inequalities and these reprisals against African Americans, NAACP attorneys filed contempt charges against school officials in Gloucester and King George. And these contempt charges sort of hang over the officials in the county, and so they try to fashion responses to these contempt charges. In King George, they decide to put up a bond measure to build a new school that goes up on the ballot in November of 1948. At a community meeting, though, of 400 white citizens held to discuss the bond issue, the state circuit court judge sort of threatens the citizens and says, look, if they did not approve the bond measure, that the federal court might admit black students to the white schools. And if that happened, he would shut down the schools until equal facilities were built for black students. Pressured by the same judge, the school board quickly tried to equalize educational opportunities by stripping science and math courses from the white high school. White parents then, worried that their children would not be able to graduate, launched this protest. And so in the midst of the protest, then the voters actually approved a bond to build a new school for black children. Following then the approval of the bond, attorneys negotiated an agreement that restored the authority of the black principal and the faculty, and sort of the contempt charges were then dropped. In contrast, in Gloucester County, officials there continued to refuse to do anything. And so there was a contempt hearing that was held. And at that contempt hearing, there's another great confrontation between Martin and the attorney for the school board. Martin proclaimed in his closing argument, "The school board doesn't seem to realize it can equalize these schools tomorrow. They can do it tomorrow by letting those colored children into Botetourt High School." And the defense attorney sort of counters and says, what's really the purpose of the plaintiffs is to challenge and break down segregation in Virginia. It's not about equalizing schools. And at this point in time, where Oliver Hill afterwards says to the press that, you know, segregation is really a red herring in this instance, that what we're really concerned about in this case is eliminating discrimination in educational opportunities. And the judge rules, he holds the Gloucester officials in contempt of court, and he says, look, that, you know, the officials considered themselves clothed in immunity because they claimed that they didn't have money to build a new school, but if you're going to segregate schools, they have to be equal, he declared. So what happened then in Gloucester County is that they put up a bond measure that's defeated by voters in the county. They have to get a loan from the state literary fund in order to build a school. The judge fines them for contempt. School officials are held in contempt. They're fined $250 apiece, and Hutchison says, I might fine you more if you don't do something. Ironically enough, the County Board of Supervisors says that those contempt charges can be paid with public funds. So black citizens, through their tax dollars, are paying the contempt charges of school officials. The cases in King George and Gloucester reveal the challenges involved in litigating equality of educational opportunities. NAACP lawyers were steadfastly committed to undermining segregation as it was written in law. Therefore, they could not specifically ask for the equalization of separate schools, but had to demand that school boards cease from discriminating. This gave school boards wide latitude to stall and evade court orders. And in King George and Gloucester, it would take over 2 years to litigate these cases. King George would dedicate the Ralph Bunch High School in the fall of 1949, and it would take until 1950 for Gloucester to build that new school. These cases proved labor-intensive and time-consuming for the lawyers, especially when you're litigating these cases across the state. And moreover, court costs alone drained the treasuries of local NAACP branches and the state conference. By February 1950, the state conference of Virginia was over $8,000 in debt. The lengthy time between initiating court action and achieving results in the case also affected the NAACP's relationship with the local communities it represented. And litigation, of course, also had the potential of splitting the community, as some members of the community sought to negotiate behind the scenes, while others wanted to press forward for their constitutional rights. In the end, what happened fundamentally with this campaign is that it didn't turn out quite the way the NAACP lawyers imagined. That white officials refused to admit black students to white schools as a way to equalize educational opportunities. Instead, white officials did everything they could to stall and evade court orders to build new schools for African Americans. And as a result, two things happened. One is white officials, for the first time in the state of Virginia, spent more money on education for black students than they ever expected to spend. But more importantly, rather than convincing state officials to dismantle segregation, it only deepened their financial and ideological commitment to maintaining it. And so by 1950, the NAACP realizes that a change in strategy, in Spotswood Robinson's words, was really inevitable. And that he wrote in an article in The Crisis in early 1951 that as a result of this litigation campaign, that what they ended up doing was, quote, "We were nailing the lid on our own coffin by the production of newer and costlier monuments to segregation as byproducts of our efforts." And so through these efforts, though, NAACP activists laid the groundwork for not only a broader challenge to segregation in the state, but also they paved the way for the direct assault on segregation and education that the association would wage across the South during the 1950s and 1960s.